This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Will Haygood has traveled around America and the world, reporting for the Boston Globe. But for his new book, A Family Memoir, he returned to his hometown, Columbus, Ohio. He writes, "There were things in my family I guess I was not meant to know. I never knew my father, never knew him like a son knows a father. I never knew why my mother sometimes disappeared. For years, I didn't know about my brother, the pimp, my father's bastard son, who in due time came rolling thunderously into all of our lives." Haygood's new book is called The Haygoods of Columbus. He's also the author of a biography of Adam Clayton Powell called King of the Cats. Haygood grew up in his grandparents' house. They were from the South, as were a lot of people from his neighborhood. I asked him if he associated certain foods, customs, and speaking styles with the South, or if he thought they were just part of his neighborhood.
I just thought it was part of my neighborhood. I mean, we had huge Sunday dinners. And my grandfather had a very, very strong work ethic. He went to work every day, and he did not really understand people who didn't work, nor did he like them. He was a very honorable and honest man. He was semi-literate, but he was full of wisdom. He had a little garden in back of the house, and he grew vegetables. And it meant a lot to him, I think, to have a teeny tiny piece of real estate and to prove to relatives who came to visit us from the South that he had tilled his own garden very well and that he had raised his family very well. He was just a fascinating man to me.
You didn't know your father very well when you were growing up. He and your mother separated when you were very young, and you were raised by your mother and your grandparents. When you were, I forget how old you were actually, when your mother moved the family, moved the children out of the grandparents' house into your own place with her in a fairly new housing project, a housing project that was about 4 years old. Did this housing project look really good to you at the time?
Yes. It was brand new, as you said. I mean, goodness, maybe only 4 years old. And my mother needed to move away to be on her own. And I think we all, her children, were proud for her, even if we were a bit nervous. I think we were proud for her because we knew that she felt somewhat cooped up living with her own parents, and that in order for her to live, she had to feel freer. And so there was excitement about moving from the north side of town to the east side of town, but there was a little bit of fear because my siblings or I had never lived alone with our mother, and she could frighten us.
Why would she frighten you?
She screamed a lot. I don't know why, and of course, she certainly didn't mean to hurt any of us. I mean, she was a very loving mother, but she screamed more when she was away from her parents. There was no buffer zone anymore. She was out on the world on her own for the first time in a long time. And we had to cope with that. We had to cope with her sudden solo journey. She had no one in the world to help her. And we had to take everything that the world suddenly threw at her. And we had to help her stand on her two feet. And it was a time when there was a lot of soul searching by us all.
What was your soul searching like?
Well, I could not get to sleep at night until my mother came home. My mother, when she did have a job, she worked at night as a waitress. And she would come home about 1:30 a.m. And of course, that was her evening starting. I mean, that was like someone else's 6 o'clock, you know, in the evening as they were off work. And so it would have been wonderful if my mother had have come home and went straight to bed, but she did not. She came home and she played her music, and oftentimes she would bring people home with her, friends who she knew. And since I was the only boy in that house, I was the little big man, if you will, of the house. And I had to be very conscious, even at the age of 14, 13, 14, 15, who was downstairs with my mother. I felt that I had to take care of her. And sometimes she drank, and I did not want anybody taking advantage of her. I just had to grow up very quickly.
What would you do to intervene if you felt that somebody downstairs, a man downstairs, was trying to take advantage of her?
I would go downstairs. Oftentimes I had to go downstairs and talk to people, and I'm sure some of these men looked at me like I was a little crazy kid. And I would oftentimes wait on the stairwell until they left. Goodness, I look back now and don't know what gave me the courage to do that, but I just felt that I had to do what I saw my mother's father do and my grandfather, that I had to take care of our new household. I had to take out the garbage, and I had to cook some evenings, and I had to set traps for mice. I had to do all those things now, and I loved my mother fiercely, and I refused to shrink from any of those challenges.
Will Haygood is my guest. He's a reporter for the Boston Globe and author of a new family memoir called The Haygoods of Columbus. That's Columbus, Ohio. One of the incidents that I think really shows the motivation that you had when you were young is you really liked basketball, really wanted to play on the high school team. Afraid that you would get cut from the team, you decided to find another high school. So you went to a different neighborhood, lied about where you lived, got onto the team. And you did that in a couple of schools, because you did that in one school, you got cut from that team, so you found another school.
Right.
I don't know. I'm interested in hearing whether, when you were discovered, whether what you had done was seen as a sign of your ambitiousness and desire to succeed, or whether you were just seen as a small-time liar who should be punished for this.
Yeah. Well, I think in life I've needed an anchor, as so many of us do, and I loved the simple concept of teamwork. I liked to go on journeys with teams. It seemed just a lovely way to express who you were. And it was really interesting in the 11th grade, because I transferred from East High School, which was a very, very tough high school in my hometown. They had been the 1968 state champs, and just some very tall, wonderful basketball players. And I so much wanted to make that team. But the coach told me at the end of the 10th grade that I probably would not make the team. He said I was too skinny. I wasn't strong enough. I did not have enough brawn, enough strength. And I remember walking home with tears in my eyes, and I said to myself, well, gee, I've got to find another school. I've got to go. I've got to get. And I did not tell my mother, who worked that night, so she slept during the morning, so I was sort of free to roam. So I went completely to the west side of town, to West High School, and made up a fraudulent street address enrolled at West High School and said to myself, I'll make this team. I'll have a team in life to help me out. Tragically, I got cut from the team at West High School. This must have been in early October. So I was without a ship once again, and I transferred yet again to Franklin Heights High School, which was further west, completely out of the city school district. And I made up another address, and I made the team, and I was caught, and the coach was very angry about it, but there were some parents at the school who loved my enthusiasm for the game, and one of the parents agreed to sign me into his family, and he became my legal parent, and that's how I was able to stay at that school for 2 years during my 11th and 12th grade year.
So he signed up as your legal guardian so that you could stay.
Yes, and that was the one thing that my mother most feared, that if I went to a school far away, she would not be able to reach out and help me if something happened.
When she found out that you were playing basketball at this predominantly white high school, she said to you, "You're the only one of my children who eats Jim Crow." What was your reaction to that?
I was shocked. I was stunned, because I knew how much she was hurt, because, I mean, that was a term that was used in the Deep South to talk ill of black folks. And for my mother to be saying this to me, it simply pierced my heart. And I knew she really didn't mean it, but it was her only way to react to what I had done to her. I had completely removed myself mostly from her eyesight and from her reach, and she knew no other way to react. But I take a little bit of that back. She did know how to react, because I would need a little more money for dinner, because it was a 2.5 hour ride on the bus to this school on the far, far west side of town. So after school, there was not time to come all the way home and then head out to school again. So I would have to linger around the high school until 7 o'clock, when we actually started practice, 7 o'clock in the evening. And knowing that, my mother would come home at night, and she would slip into my bedroom and lay extra coins on my dresser, her waitress tips and my lunch money. So she knew in her heart, she knew that she had to help her boy eat. And she never verbalized this. She never walked up to me and said, "I'm going to lay an extra dollar on your dresser for school." She never said it, but it was always there for the next 2 years. And I could not have survived without that extra dollar every day. And it was there every day.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Will Haygood. He's a reporter for the Boston Globe and author of a new family memoir called The Haygoods of Columbus, about growing up in Columbus, Ohio. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Will Haygood, author of the new family memoir, The Haygoods of Columbus. I'd like you to tell us a little bit about your half-brother, Macaroni. And he is your father's son through a relationship that your father had before your father met your mother.
Right.
And you didn't know about Macaroni till, what, you were a teenager?
Right.
And by this time, Macaroni was pretty famous in the neighborhood as a pimp.
As a pimp, right.
And as a man with fine clothes and lots of women. He had speakeasies.
Right.
So I'm wondering what you looked up to about Macaroni when you started to get to know him, and what disturbed you about him.
Well, he was, for lack of a better word, somebody in our neighborhood to admire. He dressed very beautifully. He didn't seem to work too hard. He was always smiling, and he always seemed to have money. And when you're poor and you don't have much, those things that are very tangible can have a huge influence on you. And I first met Macaroni when I was 13 years old. He had always been the kind of hidden secret in our family. But for some reason, my sisters were completely mesmerized by him. He was a small town legend, if you will. And in 1968, that summer, he came rolling thunderously into all of our lives. And while I was entranced by him, he also frightened me. And I think the reason he frightened me is because I never could quite pin down how he got his money. It was criminal, but I sort of couldn't see the crime taking place. And as a young kid, and being a skinny kid, I was very afraid of doing anything that might land me in a juvenile home or jail. And the thing that feared me about Macaroni is that he had already been to jail. When I first met him, he had just been released from jail. He had just served a year in jail, and that gave him a certain kind of aura that I feared. So that's how I first met him.
Well, you say, you know, at the speakeasies that he ran, your sisters were really comfortable there, but you were always on edge. You were always afraid that the police were going to come and that you'd be arrested. Did you want to be as comfortable as your sisters were? Did you want to be able to just, like, relax?
I did, but I never could. I was always looking out of the windows and watching each car as it pulled up, because I did not want to be taken to jail under no circumstances. And I think that I was wondering why my siblings were so enamored of Macaroni, and I was thinking subconsciously, well, maybe there's something wrong with me. Maybe I should be more loose, at ease, more in love with our newfound brother. But for the life of me, I could never bring myself to that point.
Nevertheless, did you start dressing more like him when you were in his company and start,
yes,
like borrowing some of his language or maybe even borrowing some of his attitudes toward women?
Yes. Shamefully, I did. My sister, Diane, who's a very large character in this family, was also a seamstress, and she made his clothes, very flashy clothes back in the late 60s and early 70s. And I asked her to make me some of those clothes, and she did. And sometimes I would go out with the Macaroni, and I would meet some of his ladies of the evening. And I entertained thoughts in the far recesses of my mind that perhaps I was being groomed to be a pimp. Even though I was shy around girls and did not want anybody's money except my own money. And that two-bit dream faded quickly one evening when a young lady, I was 20 years old, I had asked her for $20, and she gave me the $20, and it just seemed like magic. And I knew as soon as I had her $20 in my hand that it was wrong. I had no business with her money, but I thought for a brief shining moment I could do what he did, until a few nights later she came over to my house where I was staying with my grandparents. And she knocked on the door very hard, and I came downstairs. It was late at night, and I asked her what she wanted, and she said she wanted her $20 back. And she said this very loudly. And she stood there with one of those, I'm going to stay here until I have my $20 looks in her eyes. And so that marked the end of my dream of trying to be slick.
Mm-hmm. No,
I was too square for that world. I was too square for that world.
Will Haygood is the author of The Haygoods of Columbus, a family memoir. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Boston Globe reporter Will Haygood. His new book is a memoir about growing up in Ohio called The Haygoods of Columbus. When we left off, he was telling us about how his life changed after he met his half-brother Macaroni, a pimp and small-time thief who also ran speakeasies in Columbus. As your half-brother Macaroni got deeper and deeper into trouble, you had to take on some responsibility for him. He basically disappeared after a while. Off on the West Coast, as did your brother Harry, who we haven't mentioned yet. Just say a word or two about Harry before we continue the story.
Well, Harry is my only full-blood brother, and I'm very close to him. And he was a very charming figure in our family, very handsome and just a very charming figure. He went away to the Navy in 1967. And Harry was also, Harry was always hypnotized in the nightclub world in life. He really was sucked into that world, and he really loved it. He also had a lot of reckless courage, and so Harry and Macaroni both went out to the West Coast.
And you had to go off in search of them after the family had stopped hearing a word from them, had no idea where they were. So how did you go about looking for them?
Well, this was in 1992. Both Macaroni and Harry were in Los Angeles at the time, and they were slowly but surely vanishing from the family's radar screen. And then there came a point where there were 7 months and no one in the family had heard from them. And I was frankly getting tired of being asked questions about them. I was living on the East Coast. And my thinking was that they were grown men and that if they were doing something illegal, that they were going to have to pay for it some way. And yet I genuinely wondered about them. And my sister Diane convinced me to go west and look for them. And I have several newspaper friends in the Los Angeles area. And we started looking for Harry first. And I had heard that Harry was homeless and living on the streets. So we visited every homeless shelter on Skid Row in Los Angeles. And we left notices to how Harry could get in touch with me. And it took 2 weeks later. And 2 weeks later, he called home. And I was so pleased that he was living. He was okay. He was on Skid Row. Macaroni had left L.A. and went north to Frisco.
And he ended up in prison. He ended up in San Quentin.
In San Quentin.
Which is where you tracked him down.
Is where I tracked him down, yes.
You found your brother Harry living on the street in a large cardboard carton. You said the kind of cartons that refrigerators come in.
Yes.
And I'm wondering what your reaction was, you know, knowing that your own brother was living in a box on the street.
Yes. I scolded him. I scolded him, and I told him that he was raised much better than that and that he was going to have to pick himself up and that I could not accept this. Seeing him, who I had always looked up to in life, that I could not accept this, that this would break our mother's heart, and that he must pick himself up. And I turned from him out there, and I just started crying. I mean, it was very painful. I mean, to see this once handsome, very charming man living on the streets. It was extraordinarily painful. And I just broke out in tears.
He ended up going to a veterans hospital and getting in a rehab program and eventually getting a job at a veterans hospital. He's still working there?
Yes, he is.
He's in decent shape now?
He's doing well now. Yes, he is. Thank goodness.
You had a sister who also had drug problems. And I'm wondering how you felt about the responsibility towards siblings who were in trouble. If you resented having to take time from the life you were creating for yourself to deal with the problems they were having, problems that you might have felt that they brought on themselves.
Well, there were times when I was very angry, but I think it goes back to these two elderly people who raised me.
Your grandparents?
And my grandparents, Jimmy and Emily. They would have never turned their back on one of their siblings or one of their children or anybody in need, relatives. And that really left a huge impression upon me. And for some reason, I felt over the years that I must at all costs do anything I can to help out family members, knowing that if the shoe were on the other foot, they would help me out as well. At least I like to think that they would. And I'm fairly certain of that. Harry, for instance, is a very generous soul. I mean, Harry would literally give you the shirt off his back. Now, he would ask for it 24 hours later, but he would literally give you the shirt off his back. And I think, having done in this book, that I really had to realize that it's a fact of life, that there are times when your family can be your largest obstacle. And yet, even during those dark, uncertain times, there is a bit of light showing you that your family can also be your largest strength.
There was an interesting situation that happened. You were out in Los Angeles covering the riots after the Rodney King trial. And your brother Harry was helping you get around because he knew the city well. So he was in the car with you, kind of showing you ways around riots and ways around police detours.
Right.
And he asked you to stop for a friend and give the friend a lift. And it turns out the friend had just looted some stores and had, you know, money and clothes and stuff that he'd stolen. And you realize that if you were stopped by the police, as you very well might have been, you all might have been arrested and you couldn't afford to be compromised like that. I was just thinking so much about what an uncomfortable position that must have been in, to have to like throw out your brother's friend and your brother as well from the car, or risk getting arrested.
Right. It scared me very much. And again, I had to scream at Harry and told him what a stupid thing he had done, and that I could not drive 20 feet further with him and his friend Jeff and those stolen goods in the car. And I had to ask them both to get out, to leave. And they didn't want to go. And they cursed me. And I felt sorry for my brother, because I knew that if he was in his right mind, he would have never done that. But he did, and I had to act like a sane person and ask them to leave. But that's a part of Harry. He had helped me navigate my way around Los Angeles. So he felt, and because of that, that I owed him a little something. And that little something was me helping him and his friend Jeff out, get from one side of town to the other. And under those circumstances, I just couldn't do it.
Did you have trouble saying no and then holding firm?
No. Again, it goes back to this. I did not want to go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
From being a little kid, I mean, under no circumstances did I want to end up in jail. I mean, not to mention the fact that I'm a newspaper reporter for a large newspaper, and I mean, you know, goodness, I could see the headlines now. Will Haygood is taken to jail with stolen wedding dresses. And, I mean, all of that flashed right before my mind, and it scared the hell out of me.
Your mother's still alive.
Yes.
Has she read the book?
Yes, she has read it. My siblings haven't yet.
And your father, is he still alive?
Yes.
Has he read it?
No, not yet, but he is.
He will?
He's not a big reader, but he will. And my mother reads slow, but she's very proud of the book. And I knew in many places it was going to be tough for her to read it. But she's very proud of the book.
Well, Will Haygood, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Will Haygood's new memoir is called The Haygoods of Columbus. He's a reporter for the Boston Globe. Coming up, Chinese cooking. This is Fresh Air.